For the past few weeks, we've been talking a lot about the mystery of the gospel, and that is the basically the subject, what we're wanting to talk about today. This phrase, mystery of the gospel, is found in various places in the New Testament. It's found in Romans 16:25, which we're going to talk about. It's also found in Ephesians 3:6 and Ephesians 6:19. There are many theories about what the mystery of the gospel is. Some believe that it's that the church has replaced Israel. Others believe it's how non-Jews can become Jews, thus giving them a place in the kingdom of God. In the final passages of the book of Romans, though, Paul made this statement. And he basically says, or this is what he says. He says, "Now to him who is able to strengthen you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but now has been disclosed and through the prophetic writings has been made known to all nations, according to the command of the eternal God, to bring about the obedience of faith. To the only wise God be glory forever through Jesus Christ. Amen." This doesn't seem to make an awful lot of sense when you just look at it here at face value, but I want to take this passage apart because it's really quite interesting. Angie, would you move my mouse a little bit? It's got that little circle there in the middle. There you go. This passage basically says that the mystery of the ages has been revealed through the words of the Messiah when they are added to the prophets, the context of what the prophets have been talking about. See, it's according to the revelation of the mystery that was kept secret for long ages, but now it's been disclosed through the prophetic writings and the preaching of Yeshua, Messiah. So this mystery of the gospel was coming to age and coming to the understanding in Paul's time. But I think it's been sort of hidden away for the last couple thousand years, and it's starting to come to an understanding here later on. It says that Paul's gospel, that this mystery is part of Paul's gospel. And if you look at Paul's gospel, I mean, if you really take apart everything that Paul writes, it really boils down to just basically one big problem, and that is the problem between non-Jews becoming a part of Israel. And Paul's gospel was that non-Jews did not have to convert to Judaism in order to be a part of the kingdom of God, in order to have a place in the kingdom of God. And Paul goes on to say that the words of the Messiah and the prophets basically support his view on this. Paul is trying to convey that Israel, the northern tribes, are now able to return to fellowship on equal terms with their brother Judah. And this is the point that Paul is making basically all through the scripture, but specifically in the book of Romans. In this study, we're going to take a look at some of the various New Testament passages concerning the lost tribes, and then we're going to apply them to see how they pertain to this mystery of the gospel concept. We'll combine the things that we've talked about in these past few weeks with the things that we've got here today, and I think that we'll be able to come to a pretty good understanding of what the mystery of the gospel actually is. And I think we're going to be excited to see at the end what it's all about. But first, I want to bring out a few historical references that point to the fact that the lost tribes of Israel were not Jews. And this is something that's really confusing today. I got on a number of websites and sort of searching this out. And if you were to look up, just Google lost tribes of Israel, or Google Two House more specifically, you will find writer after writer after writer talking about how it's a big heresy, because everybody knows that all the Israelites are Jews. And Jim alluded to it today. Even a pretty noted anti-missionary guy, when I say anti-missionary, it means he's teaching Messiah, Michael Brown. Do you ever remember Michael Brown? He put a book out. He had a big video about where he debated this rabbi, and and basically show the rabbi that, you know, that Yeshua is Messiah. Michael Brown, in his website, just crushes the two-house theory. I mean, he just blows it to pieces in his mind, because his premise is that everybody knows that all Israelites are Jews. And so, basically, if your premise is wrong, then your whole argument is wrong, and that's what his premise was. And, of course, you could just tear it apart if you wanted to tear it apart. So, we're going to look at some of the historical references that show that in the first century, the Jewish people did not consider the tribes to be a part of Israel. So, first thing we want to do is turn to 2 Kings. We're going to see something here. This was written, the book of 2 Kings was written right at the beginning of the Babylonian captivity. Now, of course, the Babylonian captivity was the captivity of the Jewish people. It was written about 535 B.C., and it records the fall and captivity of the northern tribes to the Assyrian kings. And look what it says here right at the end of that passage. It says, 2 Kings 17:23, Yahweh removed Israel out of his sight, as he had said by all his servants, the prophets. So Israel was carried away from their own land to Assyria, as it is to this day. So at the beginning of the Babylonian captivity, the Jewish people understood very clearly that the Israelites were carried away. They were not with them in Babylon. The Israelites were not the Jews. And see, a lot of people, a lot of biblical scholars will say, well, during Hezekiah's Passover, which showed that some from the tribes came down and kept Passover with Hezekiah, that to them is proof that all the tribes came down, and now therefore they're part of the Jewish people. And there's other passages that they turn to show that. One passage is that I think it's during Josiah's time. Josiah was offering a sacrifice for the Jews and the Israelites. And so they're saying, well, he offered a sacrifice for the Jews and the Israelites. That means they are all together as one. But that's not what it's saying. It's saying that Josiah understood the Jews needed sacrifice and the Israelites that were scattered abroad need sacrifice. But they come up with all of these arguments to try to dispel this. But the text, the biblical text, just very clearly points it out that in the first century, in the Babylonian captivity, the Jews and the tribes were not together. Another place that talks about this is in Daniel. Prophet Daniel talks about this in the prayer of lamentation he makes. And it goes like this: to you, O Lord, belongs righteousness, but to us open shame, as it is to this day, to the men of Judah, to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and to all Israel, those who are near and those who are far away, and all the lands to which you had driven them, because of the treachery that they have committed against you. Yes, all Israel has transgressed your law and has departed, so as to not to obey your voice. Therefore, the curse and the oath written in the law of Moses, the servant of God, has been poured out on us because we have sinned against him. So here's Daniel talking about the fact that there are those of Israel who are near and those who are far away. Daniel clearly delineates between these two groups. Judah was near them in captivity. The Israelites were far away. Now, we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that some of the Jews did escape to Egypt during the captivity, but this is where they chose to go. They weren't driven there. They chose to go there instead of being taken captivity along with their brothers. So the ones that are far away are the Israelites. The ones that are close are the Jews. And, of course, Daniel goes on to say that the cause of their captivity was as a result of the curse written in the law of Moses, which is the curse of the law. I mean, I like to bring this out because there's a lot of confusion in the New Testament about what is the curse of the law. A lot of people think that the curse of the law is the law. But the curse of the law is what God said would happen to Israel if they didn't obey the law. It's not the law itself. Well, roughly 100 years later, in a prayer to included in a letter to the Jews in Egypt, there again, there's some Jews in Egypt. The Jews who had just driven the Syrian army out of Judea said this. Now, these people who had driven the Syrian army out of Judea were the Maccabees, okay? So here's a letter that someone from the Maccabean era wrote to some of their brothers down in Egypt. It says, and this is 2 Maccabees 1:27, "Gather those together that are scattered from us. Deliver them that serve among the heathen. Look upon them that are despised and abhorred, and let the heathen know that thou art God." Okay, remember God, when he told Israel that he was going to scatter them, he says he's going to scatter them among the nations. Well, here they're talking about the people who were dispersed among the heathen, or among the nations, or you might say among the Gentiles, because the words are the same. It appears to me, by looking at some of the passages that go along with this, that maybe the Maccabees thought that because they had driven the Assyrian army out of Judea, maybe they could take and usher in the restoration of the kingdom of Israel. Maybe that was their thoughts, that they could gather these people all together. We know that that did not take place, though, and the northern tribes didn't come back together during the time of the Maccabees. Now, we can even get closer to the time of Yeshua and see that there are references in historical writings that indicate that the tribes, the northern tribes, were not part of the Jewish people. One of those passages is in Josephus, Antiquities 11, verse 133. This is a pretty common verse. Most of you have probably read this verse before. But it says, "There are but two Jewish tribes in Asia and Europe subject to the Romans, while the 10 tribes are beyond Euphrates till now and are an immense multitude and not to be estimated by numbers." So this was written about 70 or 80 AD. This was after the destruction of the temple. And here at this time, Josephus, who Jim mentioned earlier, was a very good historian. He recorded the fact that they understood that the tribes were beyond the Euphrates even at this point. Now, if you've ever read any of Steve Collins' books, Steve has a theory on this, and I believe it's good, because him and Yair Davidi pretty much agree on this point, and that is that the tribes that were scattered beyond the Euphrates that wasn't all of the northern tribes, it was just a part of the northern tribes. Most of the northern tribes by this time had moved on up further north, but there was a part of them that stayed on the other side of Euphrates, in basically where Persia or Iran is today, and they became known as the Parthians. And history has shown that the Parthians were such a great and strong military nation that the Romans were afraid to attack them. They were the only free nation in the whole Asia Minor area during the 1st and 2nd century, because the Romans knew that they couldn't even, they never picked a fight with them. And according to Steve, the Parthians were the northern tribes of Israel at that time. So this is where they were. And because of this, then we can understand this next passage, which is also from Josephus. This is in Josephus' work, The Wars of the Jews. And what's happening right here is you have a dialogue, and Josephus is recording this dialogue. And what it is that there's this one guy saying, "What are we going to do? The Romans are overtaking us." And this guy's, this other person is saying, "Well, maybe you've thought of this." Okay. Well, let's just read it and let's say it. So here, let's see. Josephus, Wars of the Jews, 2:388. "Where then are those people who you are to have for your auxiliaries?" In other words, who are these people you think are going to take and help you? "Must they come from parts of the world that are uninhabited? For all that are in the inhabitable earth are under the Romans. Unless any of you extend his hopes as far as beyond the Euphrates, and suppose that those of your own nation that dwell in Adabin will come to your assistance." In other words, what Josephus is recording here is this guy saying, "Okay, we know our Israelite brothers are in Parthia. We know that they're not under Roman subjection. Maybe they'll come and help us." So this is just another proof that at this time in the first century, the Jewish people and the Israelites were not the same people. Let me get your questions afterwards, okay? So do we see that so far? All right. There are also many passages in the New Testament that confirm this. Very early in Yeshua's ministry, he was being followed by a Canaanite, what's called a Canaanite woman, who had a demon-possessed daughter. I don't know if you ever looked at a map of Israel in the first century. There is no city called Canaan. Canaanite, there's no Canaanite thing there. Okay. When his disciples encouraged him to send her away, he answered them saying, and I want to read here what it says here. It says, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. All right, so many of us accept this to mean the northern tribes, but if you were to go into Jeremiah 50, verses 4 through 6, you'd find that Jeremiah 50 defines both Israel and Judah as lost sheep. Remember in this passage, though, Yeshua is addressing his disciples. He's not addressing this woman. In fact, read the dialogue there sometime and you'll see. The woman asked for help. The disciples tell Yeshua to send her away. Yeshua answers his disciples. He's not answering the woman. He answers and says, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Well, because the disciples were not wanting him to deal with this woman, who she herself called herself a dog, or Yeshua called her a dog, actually, then this takes and rules out the fact that she was Jewish. Okay? So if Yeshua is telling the disciples, I was sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and we know this woman is not Jewish, then who is she? She's of the tribes. So here we see that Yeshua is understanding there is this difference between the Jews and the tribes in the first century. And what's also important to understand is that the Jews considered the tribes to be dogs. Now, that's a good thing and a bad thing, okay? We look at it as a derogatory term, but what does the word dog mean in Hebrew? It means all heart, all love. So maybe what Yeshua is saying, hey, this one's got more love than many of my Jewish friends here, you know? So that's just a little sidebar. I don't know if that's true or not. Another gospel passage that supports this clear understanding that the northern tribes had not joined with the Jews is found after Yeshua raised Lazarus from the dead. This event brought a lot of fame upon Yeshua and caused a lot of problems within the Jewish leadership, because there are so many people now, because of this raising Lazarus from the dead, there are so many people now who are flocking to Yeshua, and they had a problem with it. So the Jewish leaders came together and they plotted to kill Yeshua. But in order to justify their thoughts, the leader of this particular group, who was Caiaphas, the high priest, he made this statement. He says, you know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish. Now, the thing is, Caiaphas didn't have just the Jewish people in mind. The scripture goes on to say that this statement was a prophecy for the restoration of all Israel. And we can read it here. It says, he did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad. So these words that were put in Caiaphas' mouth were indicative that they knew that there was the tribe scattered abroad, and that it was the role of the Messiah, or role of this person who was going to die, to bring the nations back together, the tribes back together as one. There's a number of other passages that continue with this kind of theme. If you were wanting to look them up, Matthew 10 verses 5 through 7 and Matthew 19, 28. They continue to support this understanding. And it's really clear in the scripture, I believe, that in the first century, the Jewish people realized that they were not all of Israel, but they're the tribes, the northern tribes, were also scattered far off. When we take into consideration the fact that the Jews clearly understand that the tribes were scattered far off, we also take into consideration the fact that Caiaphas understood that with the death of the Messiah, or the death of this one person, whoever that is, obviously Caiaphas did not believe he was Messiah, but that one person had to die in order to restore the nations, and then combine all, or to restore the tribes back together. And then you combine that with all the prophetic references we've gone through over the past few weeks in the Tanakh, it's very easy to understand why his disciples said this: Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? Everything was in place. They saw the tribes. They saw Messiah had died. They were seeing prophecies being fulfilled one right after another in the first century. And so this was a very logical conclusion for them to make, that Yeshua would restore the kingdom at this time. But as we know, he didn't. And I would submit that there's a reason why he didn't. Israel had a pattern that they had followed for the previous 1500 years. And that was, things would be going along pretty good. Then they would sort of get a little bit into idolatry. They play a little basketball. And just making, they play a little basketball. All right. So then they would start getting more and more into idolatry. And then God would punish them. And then in the punishment usually was that they were taken captive. In the book of Judges, they were always taken captive within their own country. But the people would start crying out to God, and what would God do? He would raise up a redeemer or a judge for them, and the judge would lead them to battle over their captives or captors, and they would begin to walk again in God's way. And then this was just a cycle that would go along over and over and over again. They just kept doing this over and over. But Israel never really repented. If you look at their lives, they really never got it. They really never repented to the point that they were going to completely cast away the idols. Even down through the times of the judges, the kings, they continued this. I mean, practically every one of the kings involved with this. Even Hezekiah, even though he didn't worship them, he failed to cut down all of the pagan altars throughout Judea. He, you know, they just never quite got the story. As a result of not being willing to completely walk with God, they never were the example that God expected them to be. Remember, God's expected Israel to be an example of His Torah and His walk so that other nations would come and want to be a part of Israel. They never lived up to that role. In fact, as we talked about last week, Israel was basically blaspheming God by their actions. So Yahweh brought them their Messiah here in the first century. It's very clear to many of them that Yeshua was their Messiah. He was another deliverer. But what set him apart from all the other deliverers is that when he was put to death, he was resurrected back to life. But they knew him. They knew him. They felt him. They touched him. They knew he was real. But they never did have the opportunity, and Yeshua was not going to give them the opportunity to actually see Him, Yeshua Himself, redeem that nation at that time. Instead, what He did is He sent His people this time, instead of just redeeming them and letting them fall back into this vicious cycle, He took and began redemption, but He also sent His people out to teach about Him. He sent people all through the nations to teach about Him. James, Peter, John, and Paul were the four leading teachers of that day and age. These are also four leading men within the Jewish community. And they would reach out to the Jewish nation, as well as those people that Yahweh was calling, and teach the peoples about this Messiah. It wasn't going to be just a redemption and let things go on. It's going to be, we're going to start teaching about this Messiah, and we're going to let the people actually put some skin in the game, you might say, this time. But they are also supposed to witness to the fact that there was a restoration beginning, but it wasn't a complete restoration like there had been in times past. Yeshua had come to begin a restoration by living an example of proper Torah observance, dying to remove the curse of the law, and being resurrected to prove that he was Messiah. Now these men would be witnesses to the nations that these things had come to pass. So what did they do? They began to go out and preach. And James, Peter, and John went to the Jews and began teaching the Jewish people about their Messiah. And as we know, as a result of their work, there were myriads of Jews who came to believe that Yeshua is Messiah. On the other hand, Paul basically went out to the nations around about him. He didn't stay right there in Judea. He traveled around and he began to visit the peoples out in the outlying areas, some of them Jewish, but also, I would submit, some of them who were from the northern tribes. And though Peter and James were primarily sent to the Jewish people, we find that they actually themselves wrote a couple of epistles to the tribes themselves. And we can see that very clearly. Here in James, it says, the salutation here in James is that James, a bondservant of God and the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. So here's James right from the very get-go in this letter, shows that he is writing his epistle not to just his Jewish brothers, but to the 12 tribes scattered abroad. In other words, there's Israelites out there that I'm trying to reach with this letter. Huh? And they know where they are, yes. Uh-huh. He knows where they are. So he's writing a letter to the 12 tribes. Another epistle that shows this is Peter's. And Peter makes this statement. He says, "Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to those who are elect exiles of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia." So Peter's epistle here is addressed to the elect exiles. The word, if you go into the Greek, the word elect exiles can also mean chosen sojourners. Chosen sojourners. And who are the chosen people of God? They are the Israelites. And what did God say that they were going to do? They were going to sojourn. You remember, sojourning means that you are going to go live in a land that is not yours. That's why God talked about that when the sojourner came to Israel, you had to take care of the sojourner because you were sojourning in Egypt. Remember? Egypt was not their native land. Egypt was just where they were living at the time. So they were sojourners. So Peter's epistle here is written to the sojourners. Also, it's an interesting point here, just a little sidebar, and that is the word Galatia. And we know that the word Galatians comes from Galatia. Galatia is not a city. Galatia is an area. It's an area up in the northeast corner or the northeast portion. It's a land area northeast of the northeast corner of the Mediterranean Sea is what I'm trying to say. And the term Galatia, if you break it down, if you break it down, you'll notice there's three major letters in this. A G, an L, and a T. Gimel, a Lamed, and a Tav. And if you were to look in the in a Jewish dictionary, Debbie's got a Jewish dictionary. She can show this up. Show us real quick. GLT is Galut. And the word Galut means exiles. So these, more than likely, the word Galatia is actually comes from an acronym, or as an acronym, you might say, of the term Galut, or the exiles. In fact, if you were to read the book of Galatia with this concept in mind, it makes a tremendous amount of sense. Because more than likely, Paul was not writing to the Galatians, he was writing to the people who are of the exiles. In fact, if you look at the salutation to the book of Galatians, it says, to the people of Galatia, not the people in Galatia. It says the people of Galatia. Now, it also does the same things for the book of Thessalonians too. But and most of all, Paul's apostle or epistles, Paul will say to those in Capernaum or in, I said Capernaum, but I meant Colossae or something like that. But here in the book of Galatia is the people of Galatia or people of the Galut, of the exiles. Okay, going back here, going back on into 1 Peter, it says in verse 10, concerning the salvation, the prophets who prophesied about the grace that was to be yours searched and inquired carefully. So these two passages, this is the salutation. This is a passage where Peter is trying to show the people who he's talking to what their background is. And he's saying part of your background is that you are a people that the prophets prophesied about and about the grace that was to be yours and that they searched about it carefully. Well, which prophet prophesied about the Gentiles having mercy? Well, he's talked about the Israelites having mercy, that he was going to take the Israelites who would be considered Gentiles and have mercy upon them, and they would once again become the people of God. So this is a reference to, like you said, the book of Hosea here. Peter continues to describe to the audience by using passages that describe Israel in the Old Testament. And this is the passage I want to bring out. And there are many prophets who prophesied of Israel having mercy. One of those was Moses. Moses talked about in the book of Deuteronomy how God would be merciful to Israel after the exile. Peter goes on to show that his audience was called to become a royal priesthood, like we talked about a little bit earlier in the Torah study. Yahweh's special people, as described in Exodus 19. Peter says this, but you are a chosen race. The term there is actually race. It's not a chosen people. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. If you were to ever go into Exodus 19 and look up the word, a peculiar people, the word is segula, and it means a special, a purchased people. And so Peter is he's hitting the nail right on the head as far as who he's talking about here. And then finally, Peter says, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. And of course, where is this out of? Out of Hosea. So Peter is very clearly talking to the northern tribes of Israel. His epistle was written to the northern tribes of Israel. So you can assume, based on that, that there was some northern tribe Israelites wanting to start walking back in the ways of God. It's very clear. Why would the apostles be writing to these people and having dialogue with them if they were out there still worshiping idols? These people were wanting to come back and be considered a part of the people of God again. But what about Paul? Was not Paul sent to the Gentiles? As we look at some of the writings of Paul, we'll come to the conclusion that he was dealing with Gentiles in many cases, but that he was also dealing with those from the northern tribes. For instance, when he was standing before King Agrippa, trying to convince him to release him, he said this, "And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made by God to our fathers. To this promise, our 12 tribes earnestly serving God night and day hope to obtain." Now, he didn't say our 12 tribes who used to serve God. He said our 12 tribes earnestly serving God night and day hope to obtain. So obviously, Paul knew of a remnant of the northern tribes who, along with the Jewish people, were striving to serve God. These people were returning to the worship of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We can go into the book of Romans, and in the book of Romans, Paul addresses a mixed congregation of Jews and non-Jews that we might assume would be Gentiles. In chapter 9, he seems to be addressing a jealousy problem between the Jews who are with what is sometimes called Gentile inclusion. This is a term that's used to deal with what Paul was having to deal with, and this is the inclusion of Gentiles into the Jewish community. But I would submit that what Paul was dealing with was not Gentile inclusion, but he was dealing with Ephraimite inclusion. Because the northern tribes that basically fell under the title or under the name Ephraim were beginning to come back. Based on Peter's and James' epistle, we can see that the first century's apostles of Yeshua were dealing with a remnant of the returning tribes, or Ephraim. And thus it would be plausible that Paul would have been dealing with them too, or at least he was aware that these northern tribes were beginning to return. And it is also plausible that the Jewish community understood and was aware of the returning of the Ephraimites, and that they were returning to the Hebraic walk that they had left so many years before. But the Jews were having a hard time with it. The attitude toward the Jews toward Ephraim would probably be very similar to the attitude that the older child had in the parable of the prodigal son. And remember the prodigal son parable? The young man went off and took his inheritance and wasted it all. But then when he decided to return, his father welcomed him in and made him a part of the family. And the older son, who had been dealing and working with his dad and following his dad all these years, got very jealous about it, didn't he? And just to paraphrase the older boy would have said, this is my paraphrases, I say, he went off and blew his inheritance. Why is he being allowed back and given a place of honor? After all, haven't I always been with you? Haven't I always served you? So this is more than likely the attitude that the prodigal son had. Well, I think we can all support or believe that. But I submit that that's probably the attitude the Jewish people were having in the first century, because they felt that they'd been always following God. Why is it that the Ephraimites are able to come back? haven't we always been following you, God? These guys have gone off and they served all these other gods and all this stuff, and you're allowing them to come back. So to explain the position to explain Paul's position concerning the inclusion of the Ephraimites, he gave this little parable or this little analogy of a potter. And you've probably all read this before. And it says, but who are you, O man? And this is Paul talking to the Jewish people who were having problems with this. But who are you, O man, to answer back to God? Will what is molded say to its molder, why have you made me like this? Has the potter no right over the clay to make out of the same lump one vessel for honored use and the other for dishonorable use? What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction, in order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he has prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom he has called, not from the Jews, but also from the Gentiles. But we need to break this passage down a little bit to see what Paul is talking about. First off, Paul reminds his audience that God is the potter, and thus he is able to use his creation any way he sees fit. Okay, so the people shouldn't question God about what God is doing. In fact, Paul makes it pretty clear. But who are you, O man, to answer God back? Answer back to God. So Paul says that God, in this potter, making this pottery analogy, he says, God created vessels of wrath, which are Ephraim and Judah, all Israel. They are the vessels of wrath that God had created. And he does this so that his glory could be shown. He does this to show that in order to make known the riches of his, that should have been capitalized, glory. So God is saying, for his glory's sake, he is making these vessels.
He has been patient when they have gone astray to bring them back, but he didn't create them for wrath.
Okay, this is what it says, and so I'm just reading what it says. What if God, desiring to show his wrath and to make known his power, has endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? So he did create vessels of wrath. And I would say that as we read through this, we'll find that those vessels of wrath were Ephraim and Judah. But he did this so that his glory could be shown by extending mercy to those same vessels, but in their own time. And this is the problem that they were having at this point, is that God was going to extend his mercy at God's time, not at their time. And as we know, God does not extend the mercy to both of them at the same time. For instance, God's mercy, even though Judah, according to Jeremiah 3, verses 8, 1 through 10, basically, says that Judah was worse than Israel, who got the longer punishment? Israel did. Okay, well, God says Israel went through, he gave him a 390-year sentence, where he gave Judah only a 70-year. So, I mean, this is what God said. So anyway, the punishment that was on Israel was longer than what was on Judah. There was God had shown mercy to Judah at the end of the 70-year exile, where Israel is still in exile and has been now for 2,700 years. So God extends his mercy when it's God's time to do so. Knowing that the Jews understood that Yahweh had extended mercy to them numerous times, he asks in verses 23 and 24 this. He says, since God, this is a paraphrase, since God, let's look here at 23 and 24. In order to make known the riches of his glory for vessels of mercy, which he had prepared beforehand for glory, even us whom he has called, not from the Jews only, but also from the Gentiles. To paraphrase that, help make it, hope a little bit more sense, I paraphrase it this way. Since God is glorified in extending mercy to us Jews, can he not be glorified in doing the same for the Gentiles? Since God is glorified in extending mercy to the Jews, can he not also be glorified in extending it to the Gentiles? Okay. So who are the Gentiles? Well, if in most churches you would stop right here and not go any further, but if you read past this, you find out who the Gentiles are. Before we go on, let's describe Gentiles real quick. The word Gentiles is the Greek word ethnos. And it simply means a multitude or a people. It means a multitude or a people. It's also can mean the nations, but it never applies to observant Israelites. Now, there are places where Jews are called Gentiles, but there's places, and obviously the Israelites as a whole were called Gentiles. Because of what? Because when they got away from God, they were no longer walking in God's way, and thus they became heathen. And in the first century, the term Gentile basically meant heathen. And so anybody who was not walking in according to the ways of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was considered a Gentile, a heathen. It's somewhat confusing, but the word Gentiles really does not mean a person who is not an Israelite. It means a person who's not walking in the ways of God. In the first century, not a Jew was considered Gentile, or more correctly, a heathen, In the first century, not a Jew was considered a Gentile. Oh, okay. In the first century, anyone who was not a Jew, I left a word out of here. Anyone who was not a Jew was considered a Gentile because they were walking contrary to the ways of God. And so even the northern tribes, even the Parthians would have been considered Gentiles because they were heathens. They weren't walking in the ways of God. So in this verse, who are the Gentiles? And Paul goes on to explain who the Gentiles are that he's referring to. And that is here in Romans verses 9, chapter 9, verses 25 and 26, where Paul says, "As indeed he says in Hosea, those who were not my people, I will call my people, and her who was not beloved, I will call beloved. And in the very place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there you'll be called the sons of the living God." So here we go. We're going from this passage right here, 9:24, right into 9:25. Paul uses this term Gentiles, and then he immediately explains who he's talking about. He immediately goes on to explain that the people he's talking about are Israelites. This is a direct link to the book of Hosea. This passage is a direct link to the book of Hosea. And we went over the book of Hosea a few weeks back. And the book of Hosea is written about the northern tribes of Israel. It's not written about the Greeks. It's not written about the Romans or anybody else. It's written about the northern tribes of Israel. And to further explain what Paul is doing, he goes on in this Romans 9 passage to talk. And he gives basically two more biblical references pertaining to Israel to show that these Gentiles, what he called Gentiles in this passage, were from the tribes of Israel. They were not what we would really consider Gentiles. Now, Paul does this because he's getting ready to do something that really needs some explanation. And he uses this term Israel and Gentile over and over again. But remember, Paul has defined Israel and Gentiles. From this point on, almost to the end of the book of Romans, Paul uses the term Israel to pertain to Judah, the circumcised. And he uses the term Gentile to pertain to the northern tribes. You have to look at that and see.
From this point on
in that book. That's why he spends a good deal of time explaining what he's trying to do here. This is somewhat confusing, but you have to really look at it and see. And he does this not because it's a racial thing. He does this because he's trying to differentiate between the attitudes of the two people. There is a marked distinction in attitudes that he's trying to deal with. The attitude of the of the Jews in Rome was of the same attitude as the prodigal son. Or not the prodigal son, but his brother. The prodigal son's brother didn't want to see his younger brother brought back in and made a part of the family. But on the other hand, the attitude of the returning Israelites was the attitude that we want to come back. Let us come back. We'll serve. You know, we'll do what we need to do, but we want to come back. So the attitude is that of not wanting some to come back, and the other is, come on, let us come back. It's also an attitude pertaining to works and grace, because Paul, in the whole first portion of the book of Romans, talks about you're not saved by your works. So there's this attitude of works, and Paul contrasts the difference between this attitude of works and the attitude of grace, whereas the northern tribes realizing that, hey, we found grace, we can come back. And why did they receive grace? What was the key to them receiving grace? That key was Messiah Yeshua. At the death of the Messiah, the curse of the law was paid. was basically taken care of to where now the northern tribes could come back in. So at this point, we can begin to start to look at this mystery of the gospel and see what it means. But before we do so, we're going to have to rehearse a few things that we've talked about over the past few weeks. One is that both the northern tribes, Ephraim, and the southern tribes, that is Judah, are Israelites. We understand that, right? But according to Hosea, upon Ephraim's captivity, Ephraim would cease to be Israel in a civil and religious sense. In other words, they were no longer going to be a united nation. They were going to be scattered. Thus, they would not be united. You know, they would have a king over them. They would be scattered throughout all the nations. And in religious sense, God said, "You are no longer my people." So this is something we need to clearly understand. And we spent some weeks trying to develop this. Thus, after Ephraim's captivity, Judah came to represent all Israel in a religious sense. Because they were the only people acting like Hebrews. Remember, Paul made a statement in the very beginning of Romans where he says, "Not all Israel is Israel." In other words, you might be an Israelite, but if you're not acting like an Israelite, you're not an Israelite. So your walk has a lot to do as if you are an Israelite or not. And at this point in the game, the majority of the northern tribes were not walking the walk. They were not walking as if they had crossed over. They were not acting like Hebrews. And this was the case from basically 700 BC all the way down through that time, through the first century. The majority of the northern tribes were not walking as Hebrews. Thus, it's very clear to understand that because the only ones left who were walking the walk of God were the Jews, then you could say that if a person wanted to walk like God, they would be a Jew. They would be a Jew. And this will help shed light on a couple of verses. One of them is this one here, Zechariah 8:23. "In those days, 10 men from the nations of every tongue shall take hold of the robe of a Jew, saying, 'Let us go with you, for we have heard that God is with you.'" Okay, in Zechariah's time, Zechariah wrote this when? He wrote this at the end of the Babylonian captivity. At this time, if you were going to walk in God's way, Judaism was the only game in town. If you were going to be a follower of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Judaism was the only game in town. So it would be very clear that Zechariah would say, in that day, in the future, you're going to grab hold of the tzitzit of a Jew. You're not going to grab hold of the tzitzit of a northern tribe Israelite, because what are they? They're walking in paganism. Right? Right. So you would not want to grab hold of the tzitzit of a northern tribe Israelite if you were writing something in roughly 500 B.C. Another passage is this, Romans 3. "Then what advantage has the Jew, or what is the value of circumcision? Much in every way. To begin with, the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God." Where do you find in the Bible where it says that the Jews were entrusted with the oracles of God? It ain't there. This is the only place that says that. Okay? But there are numerous places that says that Israel is to take care of God's law and protect God's law. Israel was to shema these words, remember? Israel was the one who was instructed to protect the oracles of God. But at this time, in the time of Romans, where was the northern half of Israel? I mean, they were all out worshiping pagan gods, okay? So at this time, the only game in town, if you were going to walk with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, were the Jews. And so it would make very clear that Paul would say that the Jewish people were to guard the oracles of God. But this helps us to see a little bit more about what's happening here in the first century, because the Jews, being the only game in town as far as walking in God, they're having a hard time giving this up. They're having a hard time giving this up because some from the northern tribes were starting to come in. And as we know, God always accepted people when they repented. They always accepted them. And you didn't even have to be born an Israelite to be accepted of God. Exodus 12, verse 38, I think, says all you have to do if you want to be a part of the people of God is be circumcised and walk with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and you will be as if a native in the land. Well, the Jews had a hard time with that, and I submit they're having a terribly hard time with it today. A terribly, terribly hard time with it today. Because we're seeing more and more people who are trying to dispel any concept of the northern tribes returning. They're wanting to say that all the tribes are Jews today. So let's go on now. And with this background, look a little bit more about this Romans passage. So Paul goes on to talk about, in the book of Romans, about the contrast between Judah and the northern tribes. And I'm going to call them Israel and the Gentiles, because that's the terms that Paul uses. And he talks about, and here, you know, he's trying to convey to his Jewish brothers in Rome that they don't need to get all upset about this. This is what God's doing. This is just something that God's doing, and this is God's prerogative to do this. And so he makes this statement in Romans 11. He says, "So I ask, do they stumble, the Jews, in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous." Let me put this in our terms today. So I ask, did the Jews stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to Ephraim so as to make Judah jealous. I'm getting ready to go hoarse here. Excuse me. Judah, though she had maintained an observance of Torah, was blinded to the Messiah. Except for a very few, there was multitudes who did in the first century, but for the most part, Judah was blinded to the Messiah, and this was prophesied to happen. This is nothing new. And of course, actually both tribes were blinded to a large degree, because only a remnant of the northern tribes were coming back. But because they were blind to the Messiah, Ephraim, who is called the Gentiles in this passage, was given the Messiah banner to carry, and that's exactly what they did. They went out and they taught the nations, though imperfectly, they taught the nations for 2,000 years about the Messiah. But now, Israel is beginning to see. Now Ephraim, the northern tribes, is beginning to see that Yeshua was the lawgiver. For 2,000 years, they taught that Yeshua wasn't the lawgiver, that Yeshua did away with the law. But now they're beginning to teach that Yeshua is the lawgiver. And once Judah begins to understand that Yeshua is Messiah, they're going to want what Israel now has. Israel, the northern tribes, now they see Messiah. They see that he's a lawgiver. They see the advantage of and the purpose of Torah, and that we should be observing Torah. And so there's a package that God has been trying to get his people to want, to desire for 2,000 years. The northern tribes are grabbing hold of it, and the southern tribes are having a problem with it. Judah's still having a problem with it. And this is exactly what Paul said would happen. It was the Gentiles were making Judah jealous. And so you have what we're having today. Judah does not want Ephraim. Or let me rephrase this. You've got Judah, who is starting to understand Messiah also at this time, but Judah is not wanting to give Ephraim their Torah. Christianity has always wanted Jews to understand Messiah. Judah has never really wanted Christianity to understand Torah. They've always said that Torah is our Torah. It's not your Torah. You can't have this. But this is what they're dealing with. Now, Paul goes on to say this, and this is really what's interesting. For I do not desire, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own opinion, that blindness in part has happened to Israel. This is Judah in Paul's terminology, until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. The fullness of Ephraim has come in. Remember, we go back to the passage in Genesis 48. And what does God call Ephraim? What is the blessing that Jacob puts on Ephraim? Jacob says, you will be a fullness of the Gentiles. Paul uses this phrase to explain what's going on. This is why one of the reasons why, besides the fact that he explained it earlier, that this is pertaining to Ephraim. This, God gave this, what's happening right here, God put this blindness on Judah so that Ephraim could go out and do his job. And the job that Ephraim was given was to take this banner of Messiah and spread it throughout all the nations. I believe the mystery of the gospel is the story of Israel. Now I'm back to me. Forget what Paul's definitions. I'm talking about all Israel. I believe the mystery of the gospel is the story of Israel. But more precisely, it is that Yahweh can take a rebellious group of people, sift them through the nations, give them a hint of his plan, which is the hint of Messiah Yeshua, because obviously they didn't have the whole picture, mix it with all the pagan religions, and then let them spread what they knew throughout the world. But then, when God's timing was right, he would take that same group of people, open their eyes to the truth, and they will just as eagerly spread the truth about Messiah as they did the error about Messiah, thus fulfilling the prophecies about them. The grand finale is when Yahweh gathers those repentant Israelites and Judah. The grand finale is when Yahweh gathers the repentant Israelites and Judah joins with them, making one nation out of two. But this time the nation would have a solid and unchanging king. They wouldn't have kings like they had all the different times who went off into idolatry. As a result, as we talked about last week, Yahweh will save the honor and integrity of his holy name. This is the mystery of the gospel. Everything we discussed these past few weeks concerning Israel was to bring us to this point. God has a plan for Israel. It all had to happen this way because, as Paul clearly states in the very next verse, from this verse here, Paul says, and in this way, all Israel will be saved. This whole thing, for us, 3,500 years of Israel was all a play and is continuing to be all a play where God is moving the characters around so that Israel will be saved. None of it is plan B. None of it is happen chance. Paul goes and says, and this is the way all Israel would be saved. There was no other way to do it. The jealousy had to come on Judah. Judah's eyes had to be blinded to the Messiah. All these things had to take place so that all Israel could be saved. And as a result of all Israel being saved, what happens to all mankind? All mankind will join into Israel, and all mankind can be saved. Shalom Aleichem.